Support for PrayPublic is provided by Matt Fern, director of Fighting Over Sioux, a feature-length documentary about the University of North Dakota's controversial name and logo. Available now on desktop, TV, mobile devices, and select theaters. More information at fightingoversioux.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. And today we're going to revisit a conference that was held virtually by NDSU a couple of weeks ago. It was the State of the Economy, and we're going to talk with one of the organizers of the conference, Jeremy Jackson. He's the director of the Center for the Study of Public Choice and Private Enterprise and a professor in the Department of Agribusiness and Applied Economics at NDSU. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Jackson.
Thank you for having me, and happy to be here.
What is the mission of your center?
So our center engages in research and educational programs with the goal of helping us understand the institutions and policies that essentially make people's lives better off.
And what was the goal of the conference? Who attended, and what did you want to get across?
Sure. So a big part of the center is trying to engage the public and take what we as academics do and try to bring it to the people so that people can actually benefit from some of the research that we do. And a big part of that is also doing research on various policy topics and trying to produce information that's relevant as policymakers are trying to make decisions. So a big target for this conference was people who are interested in policy and who are involved in policy, in my particular presentation was focused on trying to bring some information about the current economic landscape of the state and how things are going amidst what is one of the most interesting economic times that we've been in for quite a while.
Yes, a pandemic is an interesting wrinkle, that's for sure. So the people who are taking part in the conference, were they state lawmakers, policymakers, folks who are in the tower in Bismarck?
It included, there were definitely some policymakers in attendance. So there were some legislators that were there, and we fielded some questions from several legislators. There were also a number of people attending in a variety of industries. A lot of people in the banking industries. But the conference was also held jointly with some colleagues that I have in Extension. So they serve, of course, a lot of the farm and agricultural sector. So there were quite a few people in attendance from the agricultural sectors as well.
Your presentation included the national snapshot of this time in history and, of course, a closer look at North Dakota. Where are we right now in the national economy?
So we actually had one of the quickest announcements of being in a recession in the history, I want to say, of tracking business cycles in the United States. So those who track business cycles were very quick to notice the downturn as it happened and declaring the start of the recession that we're currently in. And we are still in the recession. In terms of where we're at, it's still, there's really just so much that at the moment is really unknown. And that's one of the things that really makes this a difficult time. It appears as though the economy is going to have the ability to bounce back. So I do think that we're going to see a recovery that is going to happen. But I don't really see that the recovery is likely to be super fast, especially because the recession is essentially caused by the pandemic. Until the pandemic is under control and people have confidence to go to work and to shop, to eat at restaurants. Until that confidence is restored, we're unlikely to be able to completely come out of the recession that we're in. I mean, there has been some good news, but of course the good news came shortly after some of the worst news that we've had in history. So we had in the second quarter, one of the biggest, actually the biggest decline in GDP that we've had in the United States in a one-quarter time period ever. But it was followed by the largest increase on a quarterly basis. And so we did have that bounce back, but we've in no way come back to what pre-pandemic levels were in terms of economic activity.
And does North Dakota mirror the national circumstance, or is there a unique set of numbers that come from where we live?
So North Dakota is a little bit strange in that our state economy typically doesn't move in the same direction as the national economy. So when the national economy is actually doing well, it tends to be the case that North Dakota is not doing quite as well. And when the national economy is not doing well, North Dakota actually tends to do better. So that's one of the peculiar things about this particular recession, is that the entire country is, in a sense, facing the same type of economic shock. So we're all of the economies across the United States are moving in the same direction at the moment. But I think that as we start to move out of the recession, there's likely to be more differences in how different locations are able to recover. And I do think that we're going to see some systematic changes in the economy, a year from now, as opposed to where we were pre-pandemic, especially when it relates to how businesses are going to be changing their practices in response to this and trying to be adaptable to having another potential pandemic come in. So really trying to open up their businesses to having a labor force that maybe doesn't have to work at the home office, that can work from home, but also being able to ensure that you can sell your product to your customers, whether or not they can come into your retail space. So that's one of the main challenges that a lot of, especially I think smaller businesses face, is they rely so much on retail space, which is tough going at the moment.
Are there differences between the rural elements of the state and the metro elements of the state in terms of how you would forecast the recovery?
I do think that the downturn is probably most heavily felt in the urban areas. Although, as we've seen, our rural areas are definitely not immune to the effects of the pandemic. But the nature of the labor market in our rural communities is very different. The interesting thing, another one of the kind of differences from North Dakota as opposed to the experience of many other states, is that we are an exporting state. So most of what we produce in the state of North Dakota gets consumed elsewhere. And especially as the pandemic began, that was one of the major difficulties that we had, was that it wasn't possible to ship what we produce to the other places that we normally sell the things that we make. So even our rural places and the agricultural industries there really need some of those supply chains to be reconnected in order for the agricultural market to pick back up. But I'm not an expert, of course, with agricultural commodities like some of my colleagues are, but I'm also aware that as the pandemic has happened, I think that some of the patterns of consumption in some other countries have been changing as well. In fact, we produce quite a bit of soy, and as I understand it, China is becoming less reliant on imports of soy. So they kind of responded to the pandemic and not being able to get the imports of soy from us by finding other ways to either get it or maybe use some other things. So there are some structural issues that are going to happen. But I do think that the bulk of the difficulty is likely to fall on metro areas that are in particular reliant more on income from things like restaurants and retail sales activities, those things that really need feet on the ground and in the stores are the things that are going to have the hardest time bouncing back.
Well, months ago, the CARES Act was passed by Congress, and that national stimulus program seemed to have some positive effects on the economy in general. What's your opinion of that and the potential for another shot in the arm, another stimulus package?
Sure. And I tend to take fairly fiscally conservative approaches. So I'm one that advocates for making sure that we spend wisely. And I'm generally not a person that's inclined, and this is, of course, based upon my own political beliefs, but also my knowledge of how the economy works. I'm really not a fan of having the government support and keep businesses that don't need to be afloat. I believe in the competitiveness of the economy and that there will be natural overturn and churn in terms of new businesses coming up, and businesses sometimes fail, and that's part of the economy. But this time is actually a unique time, and part of that is based upon the fact that the government has also been heavily involved in restricting the ability of businesses to operate. And I do think that if we as a society are going to ask businesses to change the way that they conduct themselves, that it is appropriate at that point in time for the government to also step in and take on the brunt end of some of those costs. So I do think that the stimulus in this particular case has been necessary, primarily, as I said, because the government is the one that has been encouraging businesses either to close and shut down or significantly change their business models. So, you know, it has had, I think, a good impact in terms of keeping some of our businesses afloat. I think without that CARES money, that a much larger number of the businesses that we have that have made it so far would have shut down. But it is sad when I know that a lot of the businesses that have worked hard to get to where they are, I've seen, you know, many of the places that I frequent have had to shutter themselves, not even just temporarily, but, you know, they've already announced some of the more permanent closing. So maybe a long answer to your question. I do think this has been a particular instance where the type of government support that happened in the CARES Act was actually a necessary reaction.
Well, the unemployment rate really shot up for a time. It's been coming down. There's still a lot of concern about people out of work and people maybe running out of their unemployment benefits. So in the short term, let's just say the next 6 months, what kind of challenges are going to be faced by people in North Dakota who are relying on unemployment?
Yeah, and as you mentioned, the unemployment rate shot up to just, well, unprecedented levels, and it has come down. The latest numbers that I've seen coming out of the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, which they report on a weekly basis, the number of jobless claims, and those numbers had been coming down, but they're actually, the last couple of weeks have been some upticks again. So not huge like the giant spike that we saw, but what this is indicating is that while the unemployment rate has declined substantially, it's looking like the unemployment rate might get stuck where it's at. And if anything, it might even, in the really short term, we might see a little bit of an uptick depending upon what happens even you know, even right now, depending on what happens right now in terms of the economy. But it's just that so many of the businesses who were weathering the storm are now being faced with this giant surge that we've had at a national level in terms of the pandemic. And with that, you know, even if the government didn't shut down various types of businesses, so many people are just unwilling to go out, you know, and understandably, right, unwilling to go out and frequent certain types of businesses. And those businesses are struggling and closing. And that does produce unemployment. You know, in terms of locally what's happening, you know, a lot of the numbers inside of our state are a little bit slower to come in than the national numbers. But really, our job market had been so tight, and our unemployment rate didn't go up near as much as the national unemployment rate did. So I don't necessarily see us having a giant unemployment problem that's going to linger in our state. But there are workers, especially those that rely on entertainment, leisure, and restaurants. People in those industries are going to have a harder time finding jobs. And yes, a lot of that is due to some structural changes. And because of that, it may make some sense for there to be some changes in how we approach the length of terms for unemployment benefits and things like that. But again, our unemployment rate in the state is now below 5%. But granted, we're in a state where when we start getting above 2.5%, that it kind of feels high. But if you think back to a lot of the discussion pre-pandemic, one of the problems that employers had persistently had in North Dakota was that because the labor market was so tight, places had a hard time actually holding on to and retaining workers. So there's a part of me that also wonders, you know, maybe given just how tight our labor market had been, we might not actually be in that bad of a place as a state.
If you were looking at the various sectors of North Dakota's economy, we know oil has been battered by price competition outside of our country and, of course, the pandemic. We know that ag has been battered by some trade wars, but that seems to be coming back a bit. We have a tech sector. We have a financial services sector, manufacturing and retail. Who's going to take the biggest hit for the longest time?
Oh, I think it's quite obviously retail. So the sectors that rely, as I've been saying, the sectors that rely on feet on the ground are the ones that are going to be the hardest to get back. Well, I say that, but at the same time, when you have manufacturing facilities as well that require close proximity of individuals, the ability to adapt the production lines to the need for physical space between workers is a difficulty as well. But I think a lot of the firms have already found ways to adapt to those changes. But the real big thing that's going to be the lingering effect, at least in my mind, is getting that confidence back in consumers to actually visit and get their feet on the ground in the businesses that require you to have your feet on the ground.
Well, a fair amount of retail has been moving online. It was happening before the pandemic. It was accelerated by the pandemic. And, of course, our show is called Main Street, and Main Streets are typically filled with retail. It's sort of a focus of retail. So if you were looking into the future in downtown Fargo or Grand Forks or Bismarck or Williston, for that matter, how might those centers of retail activity change?
Well, you know, and even, and I actually work pretty close to, actually I work in downtown Fargo as an employee at North Dakota State. I work out at Berry Hall, which is downtown. And being downtown, you know, things have been very different. The stores are mostly open, but again, the traffic inside is just very limited. So how is this going to change the landscape? It's hard to predict and hard to say. But I especially just worry about the ability to make rent. So there's a question of I think how much willingness there might be on the side of landlords to allow for rent to be reduced for a time. But they're really, for a lot of businesses that operate in downtown areas, there's quite a bit of costs that are associated with what traditionally have been these prime locations where people travel to the destination to have a shopping experience. And now that's not an experience that they can have. So, for those businesses, this is the particular dilemma for them, is how to stay afloat just long enough. And that's where I think our retail in our state is a bit of a disadvantage. It's really the large national firms that I think, it's not international firms, that have the clear advantage when it comes to things like online sales. Now, that being said, most of the platforms like Amazon, or even if you go to some other stores websites, you can buy items from retailers across the country, right? I mean, if I wanted to, I could sell stuff on Amazon. So again, it's that ability. Are our firms able to sell some of their merchandise now in this online format where so much of the shopping has happened? And the problem is that they need to do it now. It's not like there's a real long time to adapt to this. And I especially, I don't want to be too much doom and gloom when we've also, I think, received what's really some fantastic news as of late with respect to the onset, of what we hope will be a very good vaccine. So that hopefully a year from now, we're in just a totally different situation where the vaccine has been able to be administered very broadly and businesses are able to have people normally, back into their businesses and walking around downtown. I mean, we just in Fargo have the Block 9 tower that's been going up, and they've been building this ice rink downtown. And I just think, man, how nice would it be to be able to take my family downtown and skate, here in winter? And, I just wonder, those amenities, those things like that are meant to attract people to those centers are just going to have a hard time operating.
Jeremy Jackson is a professor in the Department of Agribusiness and Applied Economics at North Dakota State University. He's also the director for the Center for the Study of Public Choice and Private Enterprise. He was recently involved in a State of the Economy virtual conference held by NDSU, and his topic was, where are we and where are we going economically? And it sounds, Jeremy, like we're going where the pandemic and the solutions to the pandemic are taking us.
It really is the case. It really is.
Tomorrow we'll talk with one of your colleagues, Ryan Yonk. He was another presenter at the conference, and he'll join us on Main Street. Thanks again, Jeremy, for taking time with us.
Thank you.
Coming up on Main Street, novelist Paul Legler will join us to talk about his new book, which is about a century-old story involving a North Dakotan who was murdered in a Florida prison camp. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The North Dakota Racing Commission meets tomorrow and will decide the schedule for 2021 race dates at the North Dakota Horse Park in Fargo. Racing Commission Executive Director Jack Schultz says he will recommend approval of 4 weekends of racing this July at the Fargo racetrack. He says Horse Park North Dakota, which operates the track, requested the dates.
One of the reasons that we are looking at 4 is so we can create bigger purse funds at both tracks, hopefully drawing more horses and more people because the purses are bigger.
Schultz says the Racing Commission approved 4 weekends of racing for the 2020 season at the Fargo track, but operators decided to hold only 2 weekends of races because of some uncertainties, including the impact COVID-19 could have. Schultz says attendance was good and more than 3,000 people were at the races, and that number would have been higher, but stormy weather on the first night of races caused the racetrack to shut down. Race dates at Chippewa Downs and Belcourt will also be determined. The track operators asked for 5 weekends of horse racing in 2021, but Schultz says he will recommend 4 weekends to the Racing Commission. A midstream natural gas company has applied to increase the capacity of a natural gas liquids pipeline in McKenzie and Dunn counties. One Oak has applied to build 2 pumping stations to increase the capacity of the pipeline by 80,000 barrels. The company had applied in January but put the project on hold. Now it wants to go ahead with the project. North Dakota Public Service Commissioner Julie Fedorchak calls it good news.
This is obviously an effort to increase the capacity of this pipeline to support the increased production of natural gas and need to process that and make use of it versus flaring. I think it's good news that the company came and said, let's move forward, because it suggests that they have production, they see a good potential future for this and want to make this investment, and they are seeing production enough to warrant the need for this.
The PSC issued a notice of opportunity for a hearing on One Oak's plans. Fedorchak says the company is planning to start construction by the end of February and have it completed by the end of 2021. And Lola is safe and back with her owner. Lola is a chocolate Labrador retriever. She was rescued from the icy Cheyenne River in Horace this morning. Firefighters from the rural West Fargo Fire Department responded after someone saw the dog floundering in the water. 2 of the volunteer firefighters, equipped with specialized wetsuits, jumped in the river and were able to get Lola to shore. Cass County Deputy Sheriff Craig Keller was on the scene.
We're not exactly sure right now how the dog got out or what the situation with that is, but the Cheyenne River is not iced over completely. There's thin layer of ice on each side of it, and mostly an open channel down the middle with some floating ice chunks in the middle, and that's what the dog ultimately was able to pull itself up onto, one of those ice chunks in the middle.
It's likely the lab would not have made it had it not been for the woman walking in the area who spotted her and called 911, and the firefighters who pulled the dog to safety. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Find out why most Brits support the monarchy.
I think we actually do love having a royal family.
Search for the pianos Catherine the Great shipped to Siberia.
An incredible piano mania in European Russia.
And Frances Mays describes what normal will look like in Italy again.
You don't need to be online. You're going to see everybody in the piazza that morning.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Paul Legler. He's the author of a new book from the North Dakota State University Press, Half the Terrible Things, and he joins us from his home in the Twin Cities. Paul, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
We talked years ago on our show about a book that you wrote called Song of Destiny, which has a North Dakota connection like this new book, Half the Terrible Things, does. But let's give our listeners a little bit of your background, because it's quite interesting. You didn't necessarily start out as a novelist.
No, I did not. I actually grew up on a small farm just northeast of Jamestown, and I went to college at the University of North Dakota. I went to law school at the University of Minnesota. And I practiced law in Fargo, actually, for about 10 years. But I was very, very interested in public policy, and I got an opportunity to go to the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and I did that, and ended up, after that, going to Washington, D.C., and working as an attorney advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services.
And an interest, I take it, in poverty and civil rights.
Yes, very much. When I was in Fargo, I represented a lot of migrant farm workers. I don't think there's many of those anymore, but at that time, they would come up from Texas, of course, to pull the beet fields, and I represented them in a number of housing discrimination and government benefit discrimination cases. In fact, at one time, they were lined up outside my door in my law office in Fargo, so I did my best to help them.
What prompted you to become a novelist?
I've always enjoyed reading more than anything. I'm a very consistent reader. I love books of all kinds, particularly literature, but virtually, you know, history is a strong interest for me. And I just thought I'd dive in and do it. And it took some change in thinking, I guess, about how to write. You know, I've written law review articles. I had written policy briefs and technical things of that nature. But writing literature is something entirely different. So it took a while, I think, to make that jump. But I'm glad I did it. And it's something I enjoy immensely and hope to continue.
Half the Terrible Things is the new book you've got out there. And the stock question I always ask authors is, why did you write the book?
You know, the origins of this book really go back a number of years. I was reading a book by David Oshinsky called Worse Than Slavery, which is about convict labor and Jim Crow justice in the South. And there was just this very short reference to a farm boy from Munich, North Dakota, Martin Tabert, who was murdered in a labor convict camp in Dixie County, Florida. And being a farm boy myself in North Dakota, this struck me. Jamestown's about 140 miles directly south of Munich. And I guess I thought that if I had been born 50 years earlier, this could have been me. So it's something that stuck in my mind and I thought about a lot. And I wanted to find out more information about it. I did some research about the incident, and I discovered that the attorney who represented the Tabert family after Martin's death, a gentleman by the name of Goodminder Grimson, later became a Supreme Court judge in North Dakota, and his law records were archived at the State Historical Society in Bismarck. So I traveled to Bismarck to see the records. I spent a day there. Their records are on microfilm. And there are many affidavits in the record because Grimson went down to Florida and took affidavits from guards of the convict camp. He took affidavits from fellow prisoners there. And I found it honestly to be a very, very unsettling experience because of the gruesome nature of his death. And it's just a story that wouldn't leave me. And I thought this is a story that needed to be more broadly told.
Martin Tabert was 22 years old when he was whipped to death in that convict labor camp by a so-called whipping boss. And the case became somewhat famous. The New York World won a Pulitzer Prize for covering this story. I'd never heard this history. It's 100 years ago now, of course, but what a compelling story it is. And I think people who are interested in the history of our state, and for that matter, the history of civil rights and those kinds of things, would be intrigued by this book. This has been called a hybrid novel by Larry Watson, who was on our show not so long ago for his book made into a movie, Let Him Be. How would you describe a hybrid novel?
Well, part of the story, of course, is about Martin Tabert and his travels to Florida and his experience in the convict labor camp. And most of that's very well documented. But when I started thinking about this, his experiences, I guess I saw it in the broader context of violence in America and the fact that we as a country often look away from that violence and ignore it. In particular, it struck me that there were parallels with the torture of detainees post 9/11 in this country and how we've never really come to terms with that. It struck me that there were parallels to domestic violence, something that until really the last 30, 40 years, we tended to look away from and try to ignore to the best we could. So those kinds of issues prompted me, I guess, to create two fictional characters, Edna Knudsen and Nicole Knudsen. Edna Knudsen is the girlfriend of Martin, again, a fictional character, and Nicole Knudsen is the granddaughter. And they're travels, their adventures, how they made their way through life is interwoven throughout the story.
Nicole is also a Justice Department attorney, and she is involved in a controversy after 9/11 involving sort of the black operations around suspected terrorists, and one particular suspect by the name of Abu al-Nasser, who died in the custody of the CIA. She has come across some incriminating photographs, and she's really the main character of the story. I mean, she's following the history of Martin Tabor, but she's the central character. Why did you choose that particular way to tell the story?
Her story, I think, helps trace the period of time because she goes to Florida and tries to find the grave of Martin Tabor at the request of the grandmother. Again, she's a totally fictional character. The person that Abu al-Nasser that was tortured in the book is also a fictional character. But they're based on, events that did happen in U.S. history. I got a lot of information from a book by Jane Meyer called The Dark Side, which she outlines very carefully the whole history of how the CIA became involved in the torture of detainees.
The story that you tell is sort of a moral evolution that this character, Nicole, goes through, and I won't give it away except to say that the novel ends in an interesting way. Along the way, you tell some important history. You talk about race relations in the South and this really interesting and terrible connection between a convent camp in Florida and the lumber industry in Minnesota.
Yes, there's a Minnesota connection. William O'Brien, who was a lumber baron in Minnesota, he did a lot of the lumbering in the early 1900s up in northern Minnesota and stripped those forests of trees. That lumbering started petering out, and he went down to Florida and bought up 300,000 acres of land down there and started lumbering operations in Florida and exporting that lumber to the Caribbean. Now, it was very difficult at that time to get labor to work in the lumber camps down there because of the conditions that were so horrendous. So they turned to convict labor as a way to supply their labor needs. And it was really a scheme which this attorney, Gudmundur Grimson from North Dakota, and the newspaper New York World, as you mentioned, helped uncover. But it was a scheme to pull people off of trains. In those days, they would charge people for a vagrancy, which could cover anything if someone didn't have a regular job. And then they would find them and sentence them to a labor camp and work them basically near to death.
Tabert was fined $25, and it would cost him about $25 to get home. So we're talking about $50 in the 1920s, which was probably a considerable sum to somebody who was, riding the rails at that time, essentially a hobo. It also points to the corruption of this sort of corporate prison system.
Yeah, he actually, when he was sentenced, he wired his family in Munich, North Dakota for the money, and his brother, John, wired the money down there. But he had already been transported to the labor camp, and the sheriff simply requested that his letter and the money be returned. They already had him in the labor camp. They wanted his labor, and they weren't about to send him back.
Well, this historical novel has some images in it. You traveled to Florida, too, took photographs of where approximately Martin Tabert may have been buried.
Yes. After I started on the book, I wrote the North Dakota scenes first. I was having some difficulty writing the Florida scenes. And, I've been to Florida like probably a lot of people. Most people have to Disney World and to Key West and beaches and places like that. But the place where Martin Tabert was murdered is quite different. It's in Dixie County. Yes, it's really called Dixie County. And it's basically in what you might call the armpit of Florida, halfway about between Tallahassee and Tampa. It's a very rural county, a very poor county to this very day. I wanted to see it. To me, it's important, too, that a book be authentic, especially a book of this nature that's hybrid in nature. So I did travel down to Florida. I spent a number of days in Dixie County, traveling around, looking, trying to absorb the culture and the scenery, and actually visiting cemeteries, because part of the book is about the search for the grave down in Dixie County.
And how would you describe the awareness of people in that part of Florida to the convict labor camps that exploited prisoners, you know, decades earlier?
I mean, I think it's in large part, it's an ignored part of Florida history. And an illustration of that is that, and this appears in the book in a slightly fictionalized form, but there's a museum down there called the Cracker Homestead Museum, which deals with the history of lumbering in Florida. And I asked the people at the museum if they had any information about the convict labor camp, which was really prevalent then, and they did not. I think it's something that Florida needs to come to terms with. If you look at the history of how the railroads were built in Florida, it's a very, very gruesome history where convict labor was a big part of that, and many, many people were mistreated, and thousands of people died and lost their lives and were buried along those roads and along those railroad tracks.
Well, you have a villain in the story who is a real person, Thomas Walter Higginbotham. He was a whipping boss.
Yes, he's a real character and a very, very hard character to write about, to believe that someone could be that evil, that cruel. But he was basically hired by the Putnam Lumber Company, again, owned by William O'Brien. He was hired by the Putnam Lumber Company because the previous whipping boss didn't whip hard enough. And he was determined to be brutal, and it is gruesome. I try in the book, I think you'll find that I don't dwell in detail about his death. I leave some of that up to the imagination of the reader, but some of it is very well documented, and again, in the affidavits that the attorney, Gudmundur Grimson, obtained. I guess I would also say, I don't know that much about Gudmundur Grimson, but he must have had tremendous, tremendous courage to travel down to Florida in 1922 and to investigate this case. And he was actually appointed down there as a special prosecutor to prosecute Higginbotham. And he wrote a historical article about it and talks about the fact that one of his witnesses was poisoned and another black woman was a witness, was shot hours before the trial. So he had a very difficult time down there. And he must have had tremendous courage to do that.
He also caused change, because this court case, maybe it didn't come out totally the way he wanted it to, but it did force change in the convict labor system in Florida.
Yes, and isn't that a great thing that some attorney from North Dakota could get involved in a case, and which would ultimately lead to the legislature in Florida ending convict camps. Obviously, there were many abuses that continued. There were lynchings that continued. Most people know that history, but because of this individual from North Dakota, the world became a better place. And partly it's due to the people in North Dakota, too. They raised money. They actually did subscriptions and raised money in North Dakota to send Gudmundur Grimson down there. So it's a great tribute to the people of North Dakota as well.
And we're reminded of the Jim Crow South in the 1920s, of course, Birth of a Nation, which sort of made heroes of the Ku Klux Klan. It was a very popular movie that came out in 1915 and still resonated around the country. It was popular in North Dakota, for that matter. This was a place where Yankees were actually reviled. It was probably a dangerous time. You mentioned the two people who died in the course of the trial, a dangerous time to be there.
Definitely a very dangerous time. And And there were strong feelings, I think, against anybody from the north that would come down to the south during that period of time. And to be honest, if some of that's extended up to the present. I'd be the first to say most people in the South are now much more enlightened, and they tend to be very good and gracious and hospitable people. But there is that undercurrent, especially among older people, that they still don't want people from the North coming down there. They still call them Yankees and prefer to handle things their own.
Well, the book is Half the Terrible Things. It's by Paul Legler. It's out by the NDSU Press, just released this month. And there was a tremendous amount of history acknowledged in the book. You've mentioned it, Paul, in our discussion. But in the back, there are reference materials that indicate sources for the information that you present in the story. And there's also something I was not aware of either. And there's a poem by Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, a very famous poet, about Martin Tabard.
Yes, I would urge people to read that poem. She was a very interesting individual in her own right. And I couldn't hardly believe it when I looked at her date of birth and date of death. She lived to be 108 years old, but she was very active in not only as a poet, but also in the environmental movement. To save the Everglades in Florida. But to me, it's a very, very moving poem, and I'm glad we could include it in the book. And I encourage people to make sure you read the book to the very end and read that poem as well.
Are you working on something now?
I am currently working on another book, somewhat similar in a way. It's based on a true incident in North Dakota. This involves some nuns at a convent in Dickinson, North Dakota, five nuns who died of poisoning within days of each other. It was never really determined who or what or how they were killed. They thought possibly it was arsenic poisoning, but there wasn't an accurate test for arsenic poisoning at the time. So, again, it's a fictional account, but it's based on a true incident. So I'm having fun working on that.
Well, we look forward to talking to you about that book when it's released. Paul Legler is the author of Half the Terrible Things. Thank you, Paul, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dakota Datebook is next.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight,
Ken Burns has made some of the most acclaimed and important documentaries of all time. The historian Stephen Ambrose said more Americans get their history from Ken Burns than any other source.
We need to be reminded of our stories.
From Hooligan Films and Phantasma Pictures, an exclusive and intimate look at America's most prolific documentary filmmaker, Ken Burns, Here and There.
Watch Ken Burns Here and There tonight at 8:30 Central, 7:30 Mountain on Prairie Public.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 2nd. The Grand Forks area saw a smallpox epidemic in the fall of 1878 that killed the city's first physician. Few newspaper accounts exist about the outbreak, but one family's history links the epidemic to a neighbor who knocked on the family's door and collapsed unconscious onto their kitchen floor, bleeding from smallpox. Of the six people at home, three were sickened and died, the father and two small daughters, just days apart. Their bodies were placed in wooden coffins, sprinkled with lye, and buried in the family's pasture, but were later exhumed and reburied in a cemetery. The mother was pregnant. She was infected, but survived, and suffered impaired vision. She gave birth to a son. The epidemic affected the small town of Grand Forks and nearby America's Township, south of town. Dr. George Hexton of Grand Forks died from the disease that November. He was 37 years old. His body was immediately buried and his clothes taken a half mile out of town and burned. His house was fumigated with sulfur and chlorine gas and also whitewashed. The people who tended to this work also burned their clothes. 2 to 4 dozen people fell ill, including a newborn. The Grand Forks County Board of Commissioners and the commander of Fort Pembina established a quarantine on the area.
Local officials apparently tried to keep the epidemic a secret. The St. Paul Pioneer Press learned of the outbreak from people coming from the Grand Forks area, calling them refugees. They told of several smallpox deaths, and at least 8 people died. One America's Township resident later recounted, "We were almost completely isolated, or rather locked out, because of the terrible fear that had gotten into the people." A doctor had come to tend to Dr. Haxton in the week before his death. He also vaccinated hundreds of people for smallpox, but took ill and could not continue. A third physician from St. Paul responded. The county commission gave him full authority to do whatever to aid the sick and to prevent the outbreak's spread. He visited sick families and changed his clothes before and after every visit. He went from house to house, vaccinating hundreds of people and fumigating the homes of those infected. On this date, in 1878, the epidemic was waning, and the doctor was preparing to return to St. Paul. He recommended that patients recovering from the illness burn their clothes and whitewash their homes. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
In California, intensive care units are close to full.
You know, our COVID rate right now of hospitalizations is at the same level it was at our peak in July.
And the latest coronavirus surge is putting more pressure on healthcare workers.
I never thought we'd, you know, have to deal with this level. And it's not over yet.
California hospitals at their breaking point on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Matt Fern, director of Fighting Over Sioux, a feature-length documentary about the University of North Dakota's controversial name and logo. Available now on desktop, TV, mobile devices, and select theaters. More information at fightingoversioux.com.
However you joined us today for Main Street, online or by the radio, thanks for being with us. And remember, you can find any Main Street show after the broadcast at prairiepublic.org. Thursday on our show, we'll hear more insights from the recent State of the Economy conference that was held virtually by North Dakota State University. Dr. Ryan Yonk looked at economic development during the pandemic and the role of the state's legacy fund. We'll share another story from Telltale, Dakota Folk Life and Stories. And Sue Balcom will talk about Christmas cookies for Main Street Eats. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.